The stones do not lie. Let's begin today with just a little bit of a guessing game. You always like those? Really? Do you really like those things? Okay. See if you can figure out this thing I'm describing and how fast you can figure it out. The item I'm thinking about is used about 400 billion times a year worldwide, and it's still growing. In the United States alone, it represents a $19 billion industry, and only oil represents a larger import value than this product. It is something we consume by taking into our bodies, and health experts, through medical studies, and despite what my dear wife thinks, have proven its positive effects on the human body. Currently, researchers tell us that this particular product delivers more antioxidants to our diet than all the fruit, vegetables, and nuts that we eat. There is now medical evidence that it reduces your chance of getting Parkinson's disease, liver and colon cancer, cirrhosis of the liver, type 2 diabetes, and as a bonus, it improves male fertility. Recently, it was reported that in its freeze-dried state, it's also a very excellent source of fiber. And it tastes better than prunes, they tell me. I don't know. It can also, surprisingly, protect you from skin cancer, but you have to spread it on your skin for that to work. This product has an impressive chemical makeup of over 4,000 distinct chemical components. And if you add water, cream, and sugar, the number jumps to over 1,000 more. You know what I'm describing? It's coffee. That's right. Which, how many of you had one already today? Oh yeah, a lot of you. Coffee, the wonderful nectar. I get in trouble when I say the nectar of the gods sometimes, a joke, but it's served in a variety of ways, and it's served in a myriad of places. Double doubles, lattes, ice caps, espressos, all available at hundreds of locations in this county alone. What's your favorite way to enjoy this wonderful elixir? Where's the best place to buy it in Norfolk? Even now, some of you are sitting there thinking, gee, you know what? I could go for a cup of coffee right about now. Maybe an espresso to fight off the grogginess I got going on here. But how many of you avid coffee drinkers know of a particular variety of coffee called Kopi Luwak? You ever heard of this? Surprisingly, it's a special coffee that's mentioned by name in the movie The Bucket List, if you've ever seen that. Kopi Luwak is the most expensive coffee in the world. It can cost upwards of $300 American a pound, or $740 a kilogram. And often in specialty shops, when they can get it, brewed Kopi Luwak is sold not by the cup, but by the ounce. One brewed cup of this stuff can set you back $50 or more. That's because only about 1,000 pounds of this coffee are made in the world every year. It's extremely rare. Kopi Luwak coffee comes from only one place on this planet. It's from the island of Sumatra in Indonesia, in the region appropriately enough called Java. Now, I've been told, because, well, I can't afford to buy it, that it has a kind of a chocolate aroma with a nutty, bold taste. Are you intrigued? Would you like to try some of that exotic stuff? Well, maybe not when I tell you its origins. The word kopi is the Indonesian word for coffee. That's forward enough. Luwak is the Indonesian word for cat. Luwaks actually are referring to a palm civet cat that is intimately involved in the process of harvesting this exotic coffee. A luwak is about the size of a fox. I think there's a picture up there. There you go. It's a nocturnal fruit-eating cousin of the mongoose. The luwak is the Juan Valdez of the animal world. He loves to collect coffee. And luwaks roam the island of Sumatra looking for the most perfect ripe coffee cherries to eat. In fact, it is known that a luwak would rather starve to death than eat an inferior coffee bean. So the luwaks actually end up eating the best coffee bean cherries. And then nature takes its course. You see, the luwak's stomach can digest the outer fruit covering of that coffee cherry, but it can't digest the bean. And you guess what happens to the bean, right? Then local harvesters go around and they scour the rainforest floors looking for those undigested beans, which have gone through the cat. And now they're clean, they're dried, and of course made into coffee. Now, Kopi Luwak has another name, but I can't use it today in polite company. When I was thinking about Kopi Luwak, I'm truly amazed by the way God works. What in reality is garbage, that is animal waste, is somehow turned into a very valuable commodity, right? And you see that those similar things in nature all the time. I mean, none of you are going to want to have lunch after this. What actually is honey? That delightful nectar of nature. Well, it's nothing else but bee spit. That's what it is. Personally, I love mushrooms. I like them in all kinds of forms. I like them in all kinds of dishes. And I like them despite knowing what material mushrooms grow in. When grapes are processed and fermented into wine, or barley is fermented into beer, the fermentation process is actually yeast eating the sugar and giving off waste. And then there's the dove, that beloved Christian image. The dove, however, is just a poetic name for the trash-eating bird we call a pigeon. The pigeon that causes no end of headache for apartment dwellers right here in Simcoe. And yet God uses it as a symbol of the Holy Spirit. And then there's Jesus. Jesus, who grew up in a backwater town called Nazareth. Remember what Nathanael said about it? Nathanael said of Jesus, "Hey, can anything good come from there?" And let's not forget for one minute where Jesus was born. The story tells us he was born where? In a stable. Think about that. What goes on in a stable in a barn? I've worked in barns. I'll tell you, it's an affront to the nose. Imagine then what Jesus' first smells were when he entered this life. Animal waste. And then there's Jesus' death, of course, which we will remember on Friday, Good Friday, when we meet. He was crucified in a place called Golgotha, which really, in essence, was at the edge of the city dump of Jerusalem. Jesus died on a cross smelling garbage. Now, I know you are perhaps uncomfortable with these images, but you know what? That's a good thing. Because the first thing we need to know about how God works is that he takes life and he turns it upside down. What we think is important or valuable, he rejects. And what we reject, he makes invaluable. Time and time again, the scriptures tell us that what the world thinks is weak, what the world thinks is most despised, most contemptible in your life and mine, can become, by the power of the Holy Spirit, what is the most beautiful, most radiant, and the most beautiful product of a blessing. God then can turn trash into treasure. Just like a palm civet's waste can be turned into the most valuable coffee on the planet. God's love comes to this difficult, twisted, upset world, and he turns it upside down. Now, if you don't believe me, go to 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and begin reading at verse 18. Here's some of what Paul writes. I know very well how foolish the message of the cross sounds to those who are on the road to destruction. But we who are being saved recognize this message as the very power of God. As the scriptures say, I will destroy human wisdom. I will discard their most brilliant ideas. And that's what Jesus did, isn't it? If you want to be first, you got to be last. If you want to be strong, you've got to be willing to be weak. If you want to win, you got to lose. That is what this whole Holy Week is about. It's about Jesus coming and demonstrating what God's values are, and quite often those values are at extreme odds with this world. And nowhere is this truth more powerfully demonstrated than when Jesus entered Jerusalem. For approximately 3 years, Jesus had traveled about the countryside teaching, meeting people, and most impressively, of course, doing all these wonderful miracles. In many very overt ways, Jesus was demonstrating that he was the Messiah. The miracles, the symbols, the predictions, all of it pointed to the fact that he was the one Israel was looking for. He was the one they were waiting for. Opinion, though, on Jesus was mixed, wasn't it? Partly because of his background. He was frequently in the Gospels reminded that he was a Nazarene. He was the son of a carpenter, or a laborer, actually is the word. But still, a significant number of people began to believe that he was the chosen one. The blind regained their sight. The lame walked again. The lepers were cleansed. And wow, Lazarus, well, he'd been dead in the tomb. Got up and he lived again. All of this screamed that indeed Jesus was the Messiah. As the Passover, one of the highest and most significant of all Jewish religious and national days draw closer, expectations in the city were just ramped right up. Now would be the very time, the very opportunity for Jesus the Messiah to make his intentions known to Israel. But what exactly were those intentions? Now, common belief and expectation said that the Messiah would bless Israel by coming in and driving out the oppressors. People in Jesus' day thought that, well, the Messiah is going to be a military leader. In fact, a lot of scholars think that some of the disciples believe that to be true. We see Peter do what in the garden? Draw a sword and cut the slave's ear off. Many other ears were inclined to Jesus, just waiting for him to announce to the people, hey, it's time, take up your swords, we're going to drive these Romans out of the land. I should also tell you that some scholars believe that this desire to see a military move by Jesus may have been one of the motivations behind Judas's betrayal. Some have speculated that Judas betrayed Jesus to force his hand. Surely Judas must have thought, when the soldiers come for him, he will call people to take up arms. Yet as I said, God's ways and our ways are always, it seems, at odds with each other, aren't they? As the crowds longed for a military leader, Jesus chose to enter the holy city riding on what? A white charger? Like a conquering general? No, he comes on a small donkey. One that had never been ridden on. Why was that? Well, historically, when a king came to a neighboring kingdom or to one of his own cities, if he wanted to demonstrate that he was coming in peace, he rode not on a horse, but he came riding a donkey. Donkeys, then, are symbols of peace. Can you imagine just for a moment what it would have been like if Jesus had come down that hill from the Mount of Olives and ridden into the city on a horse? How far do you think the Romans would have let him travel? He wouldn't have even got to the city. Yes, Jesus is the Messiah. He's the King of Kings, but he's come to bring peace, not war. The Israelites believed their salvation and their hope would come from the point of the sword, would come from military strength. But what Jesus demonstrated was so unexpected that when he's arrested and he's lashed and he's humiliated, the crowds that cheered his coming have abandoned him. They even joined in calling for his death. They see Jesus as so far off the mark, so off what they thought a Messiah should be, that they now reject him. Let's go back to the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians again. God's ways seem foolish to the Jews because they want a sign from heaven to prove that it's true. And it's foolish to the Greeks because they believe only what agrees with their own wisdom. So we preach Christ was crucified. The Jews are offended and the Gentiles say it's all nonsense. Just look at how confused Pilate was. John chapter 18, he's investigating Jesus. Are you the King of the Jews? He asks. Jesus says, is that your own question? Or did others tell you that about me? Am I a Jew? Pilate asks. Your own people and their leading priests brought you here. Why? What have you done? Jesus answered, I am not an earthly king. If I were, my followers would have fought when I was arrested by the Jewish leaders. But my kingdom is not of this world. And Pilate replied, you are a king then. Jesus said, you say that I'm a king and you are right. I was born for this purpose and I came into the world to bring truth to the world. All who love the truth recognize what I say is true. And what did Pilate say? What is truth? We continue to echo Pilate's response 2,000 years later. What is truth? We see how the world works with its hunger for power and influence. We see how Jesus rides in on a donkey and we wonder, what in the world is he trying to do? How sensible is that? Couldn't God have just forced all of us into believing in him? Couldn't he have used some giant cosmic bullhorn to shout the truth into our hearts? Instead, we read of a procession on a donkey. We read of a crucifixion and we think, how offensive. How nonsensical. It makes so little sense. It's not how the world works. And certainly not what attracts the world to want to follow anyone. No wonder the Pharisees objected to the crowd's praise of Jesus. This isn't what we want. This isn't who we want. Stop shouting and stop praising him, they said. They even went so far as to tell Jesus to stop the celebration. It was as if they were saying to Jesus, even you riding on that donkey must see how ridiculous this parade is. You must be aware you cannot be the Messiah because you're not the one we want. You're not the one we expect. But the Pharisees are not the arbiters of truth. Even if the disciples had remained silent, the very stones beneath their feet would have cried out. For the next 7 days, you and I will relive how God turned our world upside down. How God took what was seemingly a monumental failure, namely Jesus' crucifixion, and turned it into the greatest victory of all. How God took the humiliation of Christ and turned it into a blessing. Most of all, we will see how God took that curse of hanging on a tree and turned it into a miraculous sign, a miraculous act of forgiveness and salvation. Remember, dear brothers and sisters, Paul writes, that few of you are wise in the world's eyes or powerful or wealthy when God called you. Instead, God deliberately chose things the world considered foolish in order to shame those who think they are wise. And he chose those who are powerless to shame those who are powerful. God chose things despised by the world, things counted on as nothing, and used them to bring to nothing what the world considers important, so that no one can boast in the presence of God. God has come and he's turned this world upside down. He has shaken everything we think we know in order to redeem what we thought was lost, to give value to what we think is worthless, namely our very selves. Hopefully this Palm Sunday will have given you something to percolate on as you journey this week to Easter.